Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Hello, namaste and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Divina Gupta. And on this edition... With that, Olympics torches lit in Greece for the games that will happen in Paris this summer. But is this multi-billion dollar sports extravaganza a bad economic deal?
When you have expenditures on the order of 15, 20, 25 billion and revenues on the order of 3 to 5 billion, you're running a very substantial deficit.
And why Chinese businesses are increasingly moving to Mexico.
The question is not if this trend will continue, but rather how much of that trend we can take advantage of.
All that coming for you on World Business Report, so stay with us. But let's first go to the US. The International Monetary Fund there is renewing its confidence in the American economy. It has predicted a much stronger growth for it this year of 2.7%, which is more than double the rate of any other advanced economies in the G7 club. Here's its chief economist, Pierre-Olivier Corunchas.
We're saying a global economy that is going to be growing at 3.2% in 2024, and we expect 3.2% in 2025. So that's a reasonable number. It's not the supercharged number we used to have from 2000 to 2019, 3.8. We'd like to get back there, but it's not bad. And the other good news is inflation is coming down. So we're seeing inflation coming down in 2024 and in 2025. So we're gradually coming back to inflation target and putting that surge in inflation behind us.
That's what IMF's chief economist is saying. But how are things on the ground? Well, with us throughout the program today is Ayoko Yoshioka, Senior Portfolio Manager with Wealth Enhancement Group, who's with us at the moment as well. Thanks, Ayoko, for joining us. How are you reading this?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. You know, the economy continues to be very strong in the U.S. We really haven't had the slowdown that higher interest rates would have been expected to have had in the overall economic growth. So he's correct. I mean, growth of 2.7% versus the prior estimate of 2.1% seems reasonable.
Yes, which is interesting. I mean, there is a sense of optimism that I'm hearing, because generally when we talk about the US, there are so many mixed signals that one gets about the number, for example, of the retail sales that we were talking about yesterday with some businesses. And they said, even though the sales are happening, what that does eventually is put pressure on the central bank, because they would then look at interest rate cuts. What's the connection here, if you could tell us briefly?
Sure. So, you know, the stronger economic growth, especially with the labor market remaining relatively strong, we're not seeing, you know, large layoffs. And so people continue to be employed. And so because they're continuing to be employed, they have spending money and disposable income at their fingertips that they're able to spend and keep the economy growing. So I think that's why the Fed has paid so much attention to the labor market overall and whether or not that can sustain the current economic growth trajectory.
Well, and that should be, in a way, a relief for the businesses there, isn't it? So let's talk to Dwayne Greenleaf. He runs a restaurant in Orange County in California. Dwayne, how's the business?
No, we're certainly seeing pressure on both ends, on both the labor side and product side. Both of those are increasing, which is making it extremely hard for a small business owner like me.
Are you able to get labor in the market?
Yes, I've been very lucky at my restaurant and my catering company to sustain the employees that we've had. But the problem I'm facing is the incredible amount of pressure on wages, not only at the minimum wage level, but then the management level as well.
I want to talk about financing for your business. Are you able to get loans at cheaper rates. Is there an indication for that if you want to expand your business?
So it's a great question because, yeah, there are a lot of people interested in loaning money right now. The problem with small businesses is the interest rate is so high, it makes it extremely prohibitive to expand the business because of that interest rate.
Well, we've had comments from the International Monetary Fund that the U.S. is on track to grow at double the rate. Now, is it translating? Is some of that growth translating into the business confidence?
If you're asking me, no. I am seeing so much pressure on wages and prices that is certainly stalled my desires to expand my business.
So that means you will be cautious this year. Is that correct in your spending?
That is correct. I'm very cautious. Again, because of the rates, it makes it kind of prohibitive for entering the market to do any more advancing in my company.
Dwayne Greenleaf, really appreciate you joining us. Dwayne runs a restaurant in Orange County, California. And as he said, it is facing pressures as well. He won't be expanding this year. Ayoko, be with us because we want to come back to you for other stories. Now, there's some interesting comments that Dwayne has shared as well about wage pressure that he's facing in his business. But he does say that the business is good as well. That means customers continue to spend. Now, this is a conundrum for the central bank in the US because some interesting comments came from Jerome Powell earlier, and we were talking about the connection between sales and inflation. Now, Mr. Powell seemed to suggest that rates might not be lowered anytime soon. For businesses like Dwayne, how much of a worry is that?
Sure. You know, I think it's a matter of time more than anything else. So as wage pressures continue, these small businesses and businesses in general are really forced to then raise prices. And that in turn leads to the inflation that we're seeing. And so, you know, if we can stop that progression, you know, then we can start to see some of the disinflationary impacts over time. But right now, because the economy remains strong, because the labor market remains strong, and there is a dearth of supply of labor, then, you know, you keep having competition for labor, which keeps pushing pressures up for wages.
Yeah, Ayoko, be with us because we want to come back to you for other stories. Now, let's go to the other side of the Atlantic in the UK where I am. And if you're turning 15 this year, there's a possibility that you won't be able to buy cigarettes ever in the UK. That's right, because the House of Commons, the lower house of parliament, has passed a law to bring in some of the strictest anti-smoking measures in the world. This legislation is now in the upper chamber, the House of Lords, and if passed, it will ban anyone who turns 15 this year from ever buying cigarettes. In the UK, this ban will also mean that billions of dollars that the government gets from tax on cigarettes is going to be wiped out. How much exactly is that, and what does it mean for the future of tax revenues? We ask Stuart Adams, senior economist with the Institute for Fiscal Studies.
The Office for Budget Responsibility expects tobacco duties to bring in about £9 billion of revenue for the UK this year. That's about 0.8% of total government revenue. Now, that is a big reduction on what it's been historically. There's been a long downward trend, despite the fact that the tax rates on cigarettes have been going up and up. Revenue's still been going down and down simply because the number of people smoking has fallen over the years.
But it's still quite a significant amount. And how will that kind of revenue be replaced then?
Well, as I said, it's less than 1% of all government revenue. So there are lots of other taxes that could be raised or indeed new taxes that could be introduced.
So does that mean that the public would be paying more in taxes?
Yeah, so if you're raising less revenue from taxing smoking, then you've got to make up that revenue from higher taxes elsewhere so that people are paying the same amount overall. So it may be that smokers end up paying less, or rather then there just won't be as many smokers anymore. But that people will presumably have to pay more tax on other goods and services, or more tax on their income, or maybe more tax on company profits, or any of the other things that the government's tax.
But here's a danger as well, isn't there? Because there could be a black market that could thrive. And those who want to get a cigarette would still be able to?
It's certainly true that as cigarette taxes tend to rise, the incentive to go through the illicit market also tends to rise. And so the black market can tend to get bigger. And there are lots of other things the government can do to try and prevent that and make it more difficult. But the challenge is certainly there.
Obviously, this wouldn't disappear overnight, would it? And it seems that there'll be a gradual decline of those smoking in the UK.
Decline was already forecast to continue. This ban will clearly accelerate that decline, but it's still going to take quite a long time for smoking to disappear entirely.
That's Stuart Adams, Senior Economist with the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Ayoko is still with us. Ayoko, in the US, what's the taxation on cigarettes? It varies from state to state, I believe.
Absolutely. So at the federal level, about a dollar is taxed per pack of cigarettes. And the average price of a pack of cigarettes is about $8 here in the United States. But the pricing ranges from state to state. States such as New York are pretty high in their overall price of cigarettes, and the taxes are high there too.
Interestingly, I was reading the report by British American Tobacco just last year that people are now moving to alternatives like vapes, and cigarette sales have struggled, just what Stuart was talking about. But thanks, Ayoko, for that insight. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. And now, in recent years, Mexico has generated significant expectation and positivity about its economic outlook, partly because of a major uptick in a trend that is called near-shoring. That's where U.S. companies based in China have relocated to northern Mexico, nearer shore, if you like, to bring production closer to the market. But it's not just U.S. firms getting in on the act. Chinese companies have also been taking advantage of conditions in northern Mexico to cut down on shipping costs. Our Mexico correspondent Will Grant reports from the northern city of Monterrey.
The reclining armchairs and plush leather sofas coming off the production line at the Manoir Furniture Company are 100% made in Mexico. They're destined for large department stores in the United States, like Costco, Walmart, and in time, IKEA. But the company is from China. It's Mexican factory built with Chinese capital. It's a triangular relationship behind the buzzword in Mexican business, nearshoring. Manoir is one of scores of Chinese companies to relocate to industrial parks in northern Mexico in recent years to bring production closer to the US market. As well as saving on shipping, their final product is considered completely Mexican, meaning firms can avoid tariffs and sanctions imposed on Chinese goods amid the worsening trade war with the US. As general manager Yu Ken Hui shows me around the vast 330,000 square meter lot, he says the move to Mexico has made economic and logistical sense. The company already employs 450 people and, he adds, has some ambitious plans. We hope to triple or even quadruple production, he says in perfect Spanish. The intention here in Mexico is to bring production up to the level of our operation in Vietnam. But it's not just Mexico's strategic position next to the US which has made it attractive, Yu Ken Hui explains.
People here in Mexico are very hardworking and fast learners. On the labor side, it's gone very well for us. We've got good operators. Generally, people stay with us and their productivity is high. So I think in this area, Mexico is strategically very good too.
The hubbub of this Chinese-owned and run furniture factory is pretty impressive considering it first moved to Monterrey in 2022. But whether it's furniture, textiles or car parts, the truth is the proximity to the United States and the skilled labor force here makes Mexico an increasingly obvious choice to locate a factory. And more Chinese companies are making that same calculation to set up their operations here.
The sofa factory is located inside Hofusan, a Chinese-Mexican industrial park in the city of Monterrey. Demand for plots is sky high. Every available space is sold. In fact, the Industrial Parks Association of Mexico says every plot due to be constructed in the country by 2027 has already been bought up. Little wonder many economists say China's interest in Mexico is no passing fad.
I understand that the origin of the capital might be uncomfortable for some countries, but the fact is that according to international trade legislation, those products and those companies are, for all intents and purposes, Mexican.
Juan Carlos Baker Pineda is Mexico's former vice minister for external trade and was part of the Mexican negotiating team on the new North American Free Trade Agreement, USMCA.
In my mind, actually, the question is not if this trend will continue, but rather how much of that trend we can take advantage of, because I am sure that some people are having the same discussion in Colombia, in Vietnam, in Costa Rica. So we need to make sure in Mexico that those conditions that are aligned by themselves go hand in hand with the corporate and government decisions that we take in this country to sustain that trend in the long term.
Probably the most significant announcement of the day is that we're excited to announce that we're going to be building a gigafactory in Mexico.
There's a second key part of nearshoring, U.S. firms setting up in northern Mexico too, either as direct new investment or relocating from Asia. An announcement by Elon Musk last year of a new Tesla gigafactory to be built outside Monterrey is perhaps the standout investment promise of the nearshoring trend.
So, super excited about it.
In the process, Mexico has replaced China as the U.S.'s main trading partner. It's a significant and symbolic change, but some urge caution over being drawn into the wider geopolitical struggle. Enrique Dussel is head of the Center for China-Mexico Studies at the National Autonomous University in Mexico.
What we're witnessing since 2017 is this profound clash and confrontation between China and the United States. The old rich guy in town, the United States, is having problems with the new rich guy in town, China, no? And Mexico does not have a strategy vis-a-vis China and how to deal into this new triangular relationship.
The talented Mexican seamstresses at Manoir Furniture put the finishing touches to another sofa before it shipped north. When an American family buys it later at a Walmart or IKEA store near them, they may have little idea of the complex geopolitics which underpins its production. But whether a backdoor into the US or part of a costly war between superpowers, nearshoring is here to stay. For Mexico, the challenge lies in reaping long-term benefits of this new alignment in global commerce while maintaining strong ties with both of its most important trading partners.
BBC's Will Grant in Mexico. Now, let's go to southern Greece. Well, this happened at the birthplace of ancient Olympic Games. It's a ceremony where the flame for this summer's Paris Olympics was lit. There were performers dressed in black and white gowns who lit a torch that will be carried across Greece for more than 5,000 kilometres before being handed over to Paris organisers. We thought of then checking how much actually will these games cost. One estimate shows that the total is currently approaching 9 billion euros or $9.6 billion, forcing additional contribution from the government in France. So are the Olympics worth it then? I asked Andrew Zimbalist, who is a professor at Smith College and has published books about the economics of the Olympics.
The Sochi Olympics in 2014, Winter Olympics, where the price tag was well over $50 billion. Some Russian research agencies have estimated it to be as high as $65 billion.
Why do they cost so much?
Part of the expense is a high-speed rail that was built between Moscow and Sochi. But generally speaking, for the Summer Games, over the last 15 or 20 years, the Games have cost over $15 billion and up to $40 billion.
In the case of Beijing in 2008, the estimates go up as high as $45 billion. In the case of Tokyo in 2021, the estimates go up to somewhere between $30 and $40 billion. A lot of that expenditure is not specifically connected to the Olympics, but connected to infrastructure that is prompted by the hosting of the Olympic Games. So when the IOC approves an Olympic bid, they require, in the case of the Summer Games, roughly 40 different sporting venues. But then they also require those venues to be connected via convenient transportation modes to each other, so that fans and so that executives and so athletes don't have to spend 2 hours in the middle of the day going from one venue to another venue or from a venue to the athlete village, to the Olympic village. The other thing going on here is that the Olympics has expanded in terms of the number of athletes, the number of countries, and the number of sports that it conducts. And the IOC, until recently, has required very elaborate facilities. They, again, until recently, they had cities bid against each other to see who could build a more impressive set of sporting venues for the Olympics to use. Another problem here is that there's inflation over time, and hence there's very substantial cost overruns.
But then looking at the kind of money that's spent on infrastructure development as well in the cities and tourism that the Olympics attracts, is there an economic impact which is helpful in the growth of the cities where they're held?
There's very little evidence that there's been a positive economic impact from hosting the Games. And on the contrary, when the Games cost $15, $20, $25 billion to put on, but they bring in the case of the Summer Games, they bring in about $5 billion. In the case of the Winter Games, more like $3 billion. So when you have expenditures on the order of $15, $20, $25 billion and revenues on the order of $3 to $5 billion, you're running a very substantial deficit. And that means there's less money, governmental or public money, to spend on infrastructure, to spend on schools, to spend on safety, and so on. And so that tends to be a drag on the local economy.
What's the future of these games then? There are cities that are still bidding for the prestigious Olympic Games to come to them. And like Paris is saying, the games will finance the games.
We'll have to wait and see what happens in Paris. I certainly hope that it will turn out well for them, but there's still a large number of issues that stand and challenges that stand before them.
What's the future of the Olympics then?
In 2019, the IOC changed its procedures. It's no longer having open bidding. They're doing everything behind closed doors now, and there's no open bidding. They're having private discussions with different cities and then making the awards of the games on the basis of those private discussions. They're starting to modify and flexibilize their demands so that they're now encouraging, and they just encourage Brisbane to use older facilities and renovate them rather than build new facilities. I'm not optimistic that it will go far enough.
That was Andrew Zimbalis, professor at Smith College, who's published books about the economics of Olympics. Now, we're also getting some more stories through the day. So let's see if Ayoko Yoshioka, who's still with us, and we can break them down for you. Ayoko, the one about the luxury brand LVMH, it seems the bubble has burst for this luxury goods owner because it's seeing a weak quarterly sales growth.
Yes, organic revenue in their largest segment, their fashion and leather goods unit, they had a growth of only 2% in the quarter, and it's the slowest growth they've seen since the first quarter of 2016, outside of the 2020 pandemic lockdown quarter. So it was a little bit slower than analysts had expected. Analysts were expecting a growth of 3.2%. So there's questions as to whether or not we'll continue to see a slowdown in luxury goods such as Louis Vuitton and Christian Dior and Celine.
A lot of this demand comes from China, and China's economic figures were also released for the first quarter today. It seems that the economy has done better than what analysts were expecting. So do we see a revival in the luxury goods segment? Because a lot of consumers of luxury goods are Chinese.
You know, that is correct. And, you know, for LVMH, at least, sales fell 6% in Asia, excluding Japan. And so, you know, you're still not seeing maybe the pickup that you had seen before. It was a little bit better than I think people had expected. But, you know, overall, I think the IMF had noted that China growth is staying relatively strong at around a little over 4%.
Ayoko Yoshioka, we leave it there. Senior Portfolio Manager of Wealth Enhancement Group, thank you for joining us. China's figure for first 3 months, Jan, Feb and March of GDP, show 5.3% growth, beating analysts' expectation. Thank you for being with World Business Report. Search for us on podcast. Search for World Business Report.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.